had started the first night at a party. We had a really good conversation about what is a role in an IA. There were two basic positions there. The first position was one of the craftsmen on the left, represented by Anders Ramsey here. And Anders basically said, well, the IA's job is to do, you know, information architecture, interaction design, interface design, and do it in a very detailed way and complete a whole product. So he's shepherding a single product through each phase, through completion, and is really looking after every single detail. On the right, we have Livio Labate, who said, well, no, I think it's more like a conductor. I'm orchestrating a suite of information products to create a kind of harmonious experience. And it's not just on the web, it's across channels, it's in a number of different areas. And so she had this vision, she's much more like a conductor. So that was the first conversation. The next day, we were talking about websites and wireframes, and Dennis Schleicher said, half of my website is in Flash. And you know, some of us thought, well, where's the other half? Anyway, the point that Dennis was making is, well, wireframes, especially simple wireframes, don't do me a lot of good because Flash is so much more complex than just an HTML page. And in another conversation, Jim Leftwich, you might have heard him speak yesterday morning, he said, we're in the last days of a static environment. And by static, he didn't mean the way we typically think of static content served from a database in real time would be dynamic, pages that just sit on a server would be static. What he meant was we're in the last days of an era when information is primarily consumed through a single device and a single interface. And we're going to see this multiplicity of interfaces that are connected, syncable, and shareable. And that poses a whole new set of problems for IAs and interaction designers. Following on that, Bill DeRouchy, who also spoke yesterday morning, presented a really interesting case study about product design, where he had to do, I think it was a stove. And what Bill was describing was, how his IA tool set started to fail him in this product because the interaction was much less browser-specific. His wireframes fell apart. He couldn't rely on those tools to do the IA job anymore. And then Jim Lush was also left with this comment that sort of stuck with me. Jim is a product designer. He has a book of a bunch of different products that he's designed across a number of different fields. And what Jim said was, it's all about patterns. He has all these different products, but they're all different, but they all have similar patterns to them. And because of his experience, he's able to see those patterns. So even though the information environment is complex, he's able to derive some simple rules or heuristics from it. So that's a bit of the background. What we're here today to talk about is the page. And this talk isn't about the page or the page being dead. It's about the page metaphor, or model, if you will, and its place in our notation systems and how we think about IA. How some of the disruptive trends we're seeing are starting to affect that model and metaphor. And if we have time at the end, I'm going to get to a couple of alternative or notation systems, some practical stuff you might be able to take away. If we're running out of time, I'll go through it really quickly and post the slides for you. But the first thing I wanted to do is talk a bit about this idea of metaphor. And this is a quote I pulled from a book called Imaginization by a fellow named Gareth Morgan. The book was written in 1986, and that's one of the reasons I like this this picture that he has in there, because I looked at it and thought, oh, sitemaps. Of course, his book completely predates the web. What he says is, ideas about organization are always based on implicit images or metaphors that persuade us to see, understand, and manage situations in a particular way. Metaphors create insight, but they also distort. They have strengths, but they also have limitations. Another paper I picked up, sort of digging into this idea, was called Metaphors We Surf the Web by Paul Maglio and T.D. Matlock. And this is a really interesting study where they looked at the language people use when they're surfing the web and came to the conclusion that people's conceptual structure of a web experience is much more like moving on a path toward and into information. And they really contrast that with the difference between the technical or formal structure of the network. And so what I want to talk about is what the page is. And I think this sort of covers our normal idea of what a page is. Some of you might have different ideas, but mainly we're talking about a document. It's viewed in a web browser. It's delivered over the internet via HTTP. It has links in it to other documents. In the Maglio and Matlock example, it was a node on a path to some goal. It's also pretty deeply ingrained in our literature, our tools, and our deliverables. And of course, the best expression of that is this quote from Jesse James Garrett and the original visual vocabulary, which says, "The basic unit of user experience on the web is, of course, the page, which we represent as a simple rectangle." Now, in fairness, another interview 3 years later, he says, "The visual vocabulary currently treats the page as something of a black box." And that's, it's a bit of a weakness in visual vocabulary, but certainly this is the best expression of the page model that we have in our literature so far. So these are the four basic components of the page metaphor. The page is a basic presentation unit. The page is a basic organizational unit. Online information. The web or online information is consumed as pages, and stuff or your content is assembled into pages. And these are the reasons I think these statements are wrong. The page is no longer the basic presentation unit. If you're at the RIA panel, you notice we're talking about panels, layers, a lot of information interaction being delivered through a plugin that's in a page, but the plugin is the focus, the page is not. If you're a blogger, you use RSS. Does anyone not know what RSS is? Okay, good. You probably come to think of something as the post as being probably the most granular unit of information you consume. It's no longer the page. In fact, in an RSS reader, and we'll look at a couple of examples, you get to assemble the posts the way you like, not necessarily into pages. Want to get that? I think I'm fine. Yes.
For the page that came up.
So the notion that the web is, or on the first plan, apparently consumed as a page, well, what we're seeing is a transition to Web 2.0, where the web is more of a platform. It's not just a collection of documents that are hyperlinked. It's a place to go to get services. It's much more like plumbing. And stuff being assembled into pages, well, stuff or your content, increasingly delivered outside the browser, and the best example of that is an RSS reader, we'll go through that, where, you know, there's no browser involved. You're directly getting information from the web right to your desktop. So, where is the page in IA notation systems? Well, the three big ones are flow diagrams, blueprints, and sitemaps, and wireframes. And it's not that I think any of these are necessarily dead or out of date, but just that we need to start to supplement them with richer tools to deal with these increasingly disruptive trends that we're starting to encounter. So the three big ones that I want to talk about today are rich internet applications. I realize this will be something I will repeat for many of you. XML content, including RSS and Atom, which are the most widely deployed examples today. And a bit about blurred boundaries between desktop and the web. So first, let's talk a bit about RIAs, which most people are intimately familiar with now. RIAs use internet infrastructure and HTTP for delivery. They have a more software-like interface than your typical web application. The terms that we're seeing out there for development of RIAs, Flash is a big one, Ajax is an emerging technology, Java is an old technology that's sort of out of favor. Does everyone know what Ajax is? I can talk a bit about that. Ajax is asynchronous JavaScript and XML, and it's a combination of technologies where JavaScript makes the call to the server rather than refreshing the page. So the page information is gathered from the server and written to the page, but the page doesn't have to refresh. Does everyone get that concept? More or less? Okay, great. So what? Two big things I would say about rich internet applications. that have an impact on the page model is reduced latency. So these applications aren't doing this page refresh that we've come to expect with clicking and browsing. There is a very seamless, not always totally seamless, but very seamless connection between the user action and the result of that. And this notion of transparent transitions, which we talked about a bit yesterday, which is that instead of you click, there's a blank, and you go to the next page, that blank becomes meaningful. So people who develop RIAs can use that transition to communicate what's happening in the application, what the outcome of the user action will be, instead of just waiting for the next page to load. And the canonical example of RIAs is the Broadmoor Hotel interface. Has everybody seen this? Has anyone not seen this? Lots of people. Okay. Well, so the deal is there's these three panels, and you can complete your hotel reservation here on one screen. And in the left panel, you see a number of dates. In the middle panel, you see a number of rooms. And you can click on the dates, and the list of rooms will update based on the dates, that based on what's available on that date. You can click a room, and the calendar will update based on which days that room is available. And once you've figured out whether you want to stay in the Premier or Superior Suite, you can scroll down and see pictures of all of these all in this panel. You can proceed to the far right panel, enter your name and information, and do the checkout all at once. So obviously there's a lot of interplay between panels here. Instead of a multi-step process that you'd find on Travelocity or Expedia, you have a single-step process. Single step in terms of pages, anyway. Personally, I don't find this all that compelling. I'm not advocating this as an approach. There's some people that say that this has led to much greater ROI. I mean, I'd like to see the numbers, but anyway, this is the kind of thing people are building into a single screen. An even better example, I think, is a Flickr organizer. Who here isn't a Flickr user? Is it? Has anyone looked at Flickr? Some people haven't looked at Flickr. Oh, great. Okay, well, Flickr is a fantastic tool for sharing photos. And Flickr is really interesting for a couple reasons, and we're going to talk about the use of Flash a bit and some of the RIA integration. But this is a rich internet application called Organizer, which Flickr uses to help you organize your photos into sets or mini photo albums. And you have two basic panels here on the left, this big panel where I've loaded all of my photos. And I can mouse over them and select them, make changes to them, edit titles and descriptions. You can see the stuffed animal there is sort of pulled out, and so when I mouse over them, it zooms in a bit. I can drag those over to the right panel to create a set. And I can name it and save it, and all in this single application. So the interaction is very rich. It supplements your usual one-click kind of action that you have in a typical web app with drag and drop. In this case, plus gives you the ability to create these photo albums. This is worth playing with if you haven't seen it. It's a lot of fun. And at the bottom, we have this slider of dates. So the really interesting thing about Flickr is that this one might be hard. We talk about two kinds of RIAs, the Flash the Ajax kind. Well, Flickr uses both, and they use both on the same page even. And so here's an example of, if you're at the RIA panel, you might see yourself in here. It's a photo I took of the crowd yesterday. And so a standard Flickr page has a what you might call a mini RIA in the middle. It's a Flash piece that shows you the photo and lets you do some simple actions on the photo without forcing a page refresh. That is, for example, you can rotate the photo, so I can change the orientation of it, and I can delete it, I can add notes to it, so I can annotate the photo, too. All that happens seamlessly within this little Flash piece. Flickr also integrates two Ajax pieces on this page. I can change the title of the photo, or I can add tags to it without forcing a page refresh as well. So when I click on Save there, what it does is it puts up a little saving message that updates the page title. It all happens within this page. Same with the tags. If I click Add, a little form text field appears. I can click Save, and it will save a new tag there. here, I can delete a tag as well. So all of this lets you perform these operations on the photo without leaving that photo page. It's really slick, and the interesting thing, I think the most interesting thing about Flickr is that there's an API for it, and I'm just going to go back three slides here. Well, this entire rich internet application is built on the Flickr API, and what you could do if you're interested is build a standard HTML application on the Flickr API. You could build an Ajax application on the Flickr API. You could build a Flash RIA on the Flickr API. So, very flexible and certainly a kind of a different model for using these kinds of services. I wanted to show this. This is another thing that came up at the RIA panel yesterday. And I didn't really get a chance to comment on it at all. And this is Dennis's diagram. Dennis, y'all remember Dennis. Dennis showed this to me at the Information Architecture Retreat when I was saying, you know, I haven't seen a good example of how people handle things like transitions and wireframes. Well, Dennis said, well, I have a way of doing that. And I think this is really interesting as a sort of evolution of standard wireframes. What's going on here is there's two pages or two states, the beginning state and the end state. Each of the elements on the page is letters. You can see an A, a B, a C, and what are those? 1, 2, 3 over on the far right. And what's happening in these bottom boxes is a description of each of the transitions. So elements A, B, and C on the bitowing deed animate for their, sorry, I'm trying to read this, companion positions 1, 2, 3 on results. Cars and minivans, trucks and SUV menus build, results lists build. So we're describing the transitions that happen in the RIA. So this was a good example of evolving some of our tools to deal with the complexity that we see in RIAs. So just some quick impacts of RIAs. First, I think one of the things that we see here is a change in focus from the craftsman model where the IA can do everything, information architecture, interaction design, interface design, to maybe a bit of a separation where interaction and interface design becoming much more important. Also, much less content here. This is much more like software. And of course, we talked a bit about the Flickr API, which is an XML-based API. There's a lot of good use of XML and Flash, and there's lots of possibilities for XML as a way to deliver content and transform it into the appropriate interface, whether it's a rich internet application interface or just a straight HTML interface. And another thing we touched on yesterday was metrics or measurement. There's a lot of measurement baked into standard web server and regular page model. All those server transactions are logged, and from those logs we get a lot of valuable information about what people are doing on our site. Well, as soon as we start to build these complex applications into a page, we lose some of that ability to measure. So we need to rethink a bit how measurement happens and how we get meaningful metrics from RIAs, whether they're Flash, Ajax, Java, or whatever. Okay, next topic. Generally, XML content and RSS and ATOM are the two big ones that are out there and widely used. But the general growth of XML content, and especially that there are good tools for seamlessly delivering or creating XML content without needing to know what the hell XML is, has made its spread much more wide. So XML is a structured document, a marked up document that has a structure built into it and validation built into it, multiple nodes. And I think the most important thing about RSS and ATOM is the really simple and flexible content model. And one of the reasons that they have become so widely deployed is that they're not all that complicated. But they are really useful. And I'm just going to talk through a little example here about what's happening with RSS content. This is an example of FeedDaemon, which is an RSS reader that I use. Does everyone use an RSS reader here? Everybody? Yeah. How about people who don't know what are? Okay, a couple people who don't. All right, so what FeedDaemon does is it goes out to the web and gets all of the XML content that I'm subscribed to. And it brings it all into this interface, looks very much like Outlook. And on the left, you have a panel that lists all the web blogs and news services that I subscribe to. On the middle, we're looking at Victor Lombardi's blog here, and you can see all of his posts. And on the far left, you can see everything that Victor's posted that's new. So a couple things shifting here. The first is, I'm not going to Victor's blog to read his information anymore. I'm consuming it here. And the other thing is, Victor's blog is set up to have one page per post. Well, I'm seeing three of his posts on a single page here. So I get to essentially change how I consume this information. And if I wanted to, it's a very simple example, but I could say, well, Victor, I just want to see his headlines. See if he's writing something that I'm interested in. If not, I'm going to skip over his stuff. And the other interesting thing that FeedDaemon will do, and some RSS readers will do, is give you a what's called a group newspaper. And this takes all of your feeds and puts them in a kind of newspaper format so that they're easy to scan. And I think this is a pretty significant shift in content consumption and delivery, and especially because it bypasses the web page altogether. And some of the impacts are, I choose how to consume it. I get to choose the interface. Right now it's very simple, but in the future it may be much more complex. I have multiple sources of information, but I have a single interface for them. I get to, if I want, think about remixing some of these things, splicing feeds together. If you're you subscribe to some feeds, you'll see people's Flickr photos, their delicious links, their multiple blogs aggregated to a single feed. I can say things like, I want to see intersection. I only want to see the things that Peter Merholz and Thomas Vanderwall blogs. If they both blog it, then I know it's important. I just want that stuff. And of course, you can start to look at the frequency and the length of the things and make up rules about how you consume them. The other thing that's happening is, I mean, everything has an RSS feed. Peter Merholz's session, sorry, I'm getting a call. After Peter Merholz's session yesterday about genre, we were talking about, well, I mean, what happens when you have your Netflix queue, your Basecamp projects, BBC News, and 100 blogs, and your RSS reader, and you're aggregating all of those into a newspaper format? I mean, what genre is that? I don't know. Seems different, though. Seems like it's not one genre anymore. It's been multiple things aggregating to something completely different. And now that everything is seen to be getting an RSS feed, that just amplifies that situation. The other thing I think is the need for good content models. I think the adoption of RSS has been pushed along by the fact that the content model is so simple. And the last disruptive trend that I want to talk about is these blurred boundaries. And blurred boundaries in a number of different areas, primarily desktop and web. But also getting out to these multiple syncable, shareable devices that have internet access. So we're not talking about convergence, we're talking about divergence in a lot of ways. Divergence or the web reaching out to a number of different kinds of devices with different interfaces. Personal and public IA, I'm probably not going to touch on that. But the boundary between web 1.0 and web 2.0. And in case you're not familiar with that jargon, Web 2.0 is much more the platform-oriented semantic web. And we're starting to see that, of course, emerging. People like Flickr offering APIs. Yahoo has an API where you can access their services through the web, but not necessarily deliver them on a web page. Well, some of this blurring of the desktop web is happening in RIAs and also applications like Micromedia Central, which is basically a flash-based RIA that sits on your desktop and not on the page. Longhorn, the Microsoft, next version of the Microsoft operating system. I'm not sure what the release date on that is, but 2006, I've heard. And then also there's some possibilities in the Mozilla XUL format, which I'm not going to touch on, but you might want to look into. So this is a screenshot of an application archetype from Longhorn, which is a travel application that sits on your desktop, lets you book flights the same way you would normally do through Expedia, Travelocity. Except you don't go to Expedia, Travelocity. You have this on your computer. It's all internet-enabled, goes to the web, gets information, but bypasses the browser. This is a screenshot from MakerMedia for their central product, which is just like an RIA that sits on your desktop, also bypasses the browser. And some devices. The best example of blurred boundaries that I saw yesterday was, Saturday, was at the Foxonomy panel, where Peter Morville said, well, I use Google Desktop Search to search for Gee's original email to me, where he invited me to the panel. And I looked at that and thought, oh, wow. I mean, this is sort of blurred boundaries in reverse. This is Peter using desktop search to get my email presented in a web page. So anyway, that seemed interesting, and sort of another example of how these boundaries that we used to see between desktop and web are starting to come together. So just a couple of impacts on these blurred boundaries. I think abstraction of IA is an important one. This, you know, I don't mean to harp on the craftsman thing, but I see IA as needing to become much more distinct from interaction design to deal with the fact that information is going to have a structure and sit somewhere, but the interaction is going to be unique to a particular device or context. Also, a big push to reuse content. Not that I'm a fan of single sourcing or anything like that, but it starts to make sense when you think of having to deliver content out to multiple devices that, oh yeah, we want the same content store to do that. Also, you need to design across devices. You can't have one solution for a web page and that thing in the middle, whatever that is, or the wristwatch. You're going to need different kinds of interaction design solutions for those. And then cross channels. Livia was talking yesterday a bit about thinking about, can we push content out to television from our CMS? And I think Margaret Handler was talking about a similar thing. And, oh, that's interesting. And clearly there's IA happening there, but no pages involved. So some things to think about. Definitely, I think the page metaphor is really at one point, the document-based web, the hypertext web, tremendously important. But there's certainly a need to evolve it, or at least come up with a more rich metaphor to describe what's happening now. With that, we need to think about evolving our tool set to deal with the fact that interaction isn't just limited to a browser. I'm virus-free, that's for sure. Evolving the tool set, and I'm actually going to have time to get into a couple examples, and I'll take some questions. I think content models, and this is something I've been thinking about a lot, but content models are increasingly important. And in fact, I think as an IA, I'm focusing less on taxonomies, less on structure, and more on content models. And I'm finding that I get less and less control over the structure, whether it's because politically forced into certain decisions, or the fact that I know that some of my content is going to be delivered outside the browser, outside the structure that I've developed. If I have a good content model, then at least I'm confident that I can remix, reuse that content in some interesting ways. And the other piece is that seems really critical is measurement. Well, a lot of our IA measurement is based on the page model, based on the fact that we log each server transaction. I didn't say not all of it, but a good portion of it is based on logging server transactions, trying to derive information about what users do based on those. When we're in an RIA world where there's a lot of interesting things happening in an application that isn't doing those server transactions directly, or is doing a number of things on a client and then delivering one result to the server, those metrics kind of go out the window. We need to think about what we do to measure those transactions. And the nice thing about that, though, is even though this is a new area, we can start to think about a much richer set of metrics, not based on server transactions, but user events. And I don't know what kind of work is going on in that field, but it seems like there'd be some good possibilities. So that's sort of the conceptual piece of the presentation. I have a couple of examples and a quick wrap-up. As I was digging into this stuff, I started to think about some tools that we could use to go beyond the page, as we say. And the two I'm going to talk about are Wireflows and Canonical Prototyping. I think the content model piece is important, but I don't have it in my slides here. Wireflows is a term that in our office we were sitting around one day going, what if we had the detailed wireframes where we show flow between pages, and we can deal with things like what's happening in the page based on the state of the page, or based on certain parameters in the flow. We want the details in the page, but we also want that high-level view of what's happening in the application overall. So actually, Matt Leacock is here. Matt, do you just want to raise your hand? So I think at UPA in 2002, Matt and a couple other folks from AOL presented a number of methods, and the method I mentioned was one of them. And what it is a really simple vocabulary to show you in-page detail, show you what's happening in the page, as well as some ways to support states and roles of widgets within the page. Not a lot of system details, and it's based on connecting wireframes together with lines, process boxes, and decisions. This is a vocabulary to show you the example. The example is much better. Does this scare anybody? I think this is great, but honestly, I think I have like dreams about this. Anyway, I'll tell you what I like about this method and the reason we started to adopt it. The first is, a lot of times there's complexity in the page that you need to represent, and you don't want to create four or five different wireframes to do that. So if we zoom in on one example here, you can see that there's notes for what's happening in the page. That little curved arrow means a page reload. You can see how pages lead to other pages, so the links that you click on go to a different page. And at the very bottom, you see this rectangle with roles and states. And this lets us show that certain widgets or links are present, depending or not present, depending on who's using the application or the role of the user. So for non-members, they aren't able to edit the collection or edit or delete photos. For authors, they're able to do that, but not feature photos, etc. So this is a good example of getting very high-level detail of what's happening in the application and doing what's happening right in the page itself. So that's one. Some cons, I think, of this method. Really detailed, and I guess if you're committed to doing something in that much detail, that's great, but sometimes you just need to do something rough and quickly, and this isn't a method that seems geared to that. Not a lot of abstraction, and still we have pages, so when the page itself is changing, as it would in an AJAX application, it's a question of how do we represent that. This is a method that I think could be adapted to support RIAs. And if you're interested in the complete set of deliverables and also more detailed vocabulary, you can visit this address, I think it's in the notes, and have a look. It's really good stuff. The other thing that I think is a little bit exciting is canonical prototyping. Has anyone heard of this? Hey, here we go. It's a method developed by Constantine and Lockwood, and it's basically a toolkit for prototyping. What you use is a series of glyphs or icons that represent materials, tools, and operations, and active material, basically stuff you can do. The interesting thing about it is it's really a set of micro patterns for interface elements. And you can combine them in different ways, because it's simple, it's something you could use quickly to rough out an interface without getting into all the detail that you might have in a complete wireframe. So the three major groups are materials, of which you have containers, elements, collections, notifications like alerts, tools, and I have a good comment about the tools. Tools, actions, you can see, you can create things, select something, etc. And active materials, so things that you can do stuff to or transform. About the icons, a friend of mine said yesterday, this is like having a language where all of the words have one letter of difference. It's really hard to When you see the example, it's really hard to visually pick out which icons mean what. Nonetheless, I think once you learned it, it would be a good system to use. And so here's an example, a really simple example of a film clip viewer, where you can see the big container has that sort of page curl at the end. You have a film clip ID title, and that little icon with the star means you can create something. You have a find button, so a search button. You have here with the title an editable element, so you know that you can click on that and edit the title. You have a container that shows the length. That chevron means that those repeat down the page. Over in the right-hand section, you have a number of different elements of frame, frame time, frame image, and some actions to perform at the bottom. So if you know the vocabulary and need to describe a fairly complex interface quickly, this is really good. Problem is you have to learn the vocabulary. And the icon set isn't all that great right now, but I mean, it'd be very easy to improve it or even limit it so that it's easier to pick up. Some of the cons, maybe a bit too abstract. No language for interplay within the containers. So back here you see synchronized selection. But what we're missing in the web world is sometimes you need to force a page refresh of some kind. How do you show that interplay between the different containers? Not plug and play means that, I mean, this method is really tied to the Constantina Lockwood use case method. And I sort of think you can pull it out of there. But they really have a system for doing application design. And this is one step in a multi-step process. But if you're interested, there's a really good article and explanation at foruse.com with a complete description of all the tools. And I mean, I encourage people to start playing with these things. I think they're interesting and have some advantages that our current tool set doesn't have. So just to close up here, is the page dead? No, the page isn't dead. You know, there are 6 billion pages indexed by Google. Page is still a valuable way of presenting information. A lot of the things we've talked about, like rich internet applications and those sorts of things, still suffer from major problems like accessibility and searchability, those kind of things. So the page is going to be with us for a long time. The metaphor, though, I think, is starting to be, metaphor is starting to age, and it's no longer the predominant way of thinking about organizing, presenting information online. So just to, Dave, you missed the first slide. So after the RIA session, David said, well, maybe the page isn't dead. Maybe what I should have said was, the page is dead, long live the page. And in a sense that the page is not a useful construct in some situations, but still very useful in others. Mary Ann Sweeney in that session said, the page is a constitutional monarchy. I had a hard time getting my head around this. But basically this meant, and the page is still there, it's still important, it's still an influence, but there's all this other stuff happening underneath that is really just as important. And what I wanted to bring it back to was something Christina said on a mailing list a couple weeks ago. Wherever there's information, we need to be there architecting that puppy. And one of the things that I really exploded when the web exploded, and a lot of our tools and our thinking is web-based. And I think that what she's saying here is that we need to take a broader perspective and think about places beyond the web, beyond the page. And I think it's valuable to think broader than just online information. And this goes back to my original point about the conductor of web. The IA is a conductor where you're orchestrating a bunch of information products. Some of them are web-based. Some of them might be mobile. Some of them might be television. And some of them might even be print. And then the last thing, and I used this slide before, something Brenda Laurel said at the ISM last year, transmedia, transpersonal, transformative. When you think of IA in those terms, you think of IA cutting across channels, IA really changing the way people use information. I think that's what we're all about. It's not just pages, it's so much more than that. So that's it, and I'm going to take questions if you have them. Go ahead.
Yeah, so you used this metaphor of remixing. One of the things that direct companies are completely bad on the shape of that is people remixing their IPs. So here it's clear that the RSS, that's nice for the blogs, but
Well, actually, I don't think about it all that much. I think that when I talk about remixing, I think of my personal remixing of information so that I can get what I need. And, you know, for me, that means I have 150 blogs that I read, but they're not just blogs. They're news services, they're podcasts, they're, you know, like I said, Netflix Cube, the Basecamp projects, a number of different kinds of information in there. And I'm using an RSS reader to remix those for me. And that's the kind of remixing I'm talking about, not someone out there remixing content to deliver to someone else. Although, surely that's possible. Well, I get to remix it on my desktop if I subscribe to the feed.
It's presented information to be consumed, and how you consume it is to change somebody's mind. And it's, there's reasons for consuming it. If we just want it to be read and then lost and not remixed, it would be a lot more like if we would flush it.
Okay, so, sorry, do you want to rephrase that?
Okay, I guess what I'm trying to say is, I totally buy your vision of these XML objects moving across the web. And I totally buy the web architecture stuff. What I'm challenging us to think about is that we also, as Eric puts some attention into how we're going to do intellectual property rights along with these objects and how we're going to be able to close the money with these objects, if we don't do it, someone else will, and it will not be to our liking, and it won't be useful.
Great point. There's something called FeedBurner that is dealing with some of those kinds of issues now. I'm not up to speed.
Just to add on to that, there is students being developed from SAML, Security Research and Marketplace, which is dealing with the choreography of authentication, privilege management, things of that, like rights management, things of that nature. So it's happening in a corporate or contained environment, not sort of globally, so to speak, in my experience. But it's still, just to highlight, it's still.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Yeah, go ahead.
You were talking about the concept models. Yeah. You also said that you're using that techniques for a moment. And what I was wondering is the concept model a wireframe, or do you have a negative one? What do you think about that model?
Yeah, content model is. Well, I'm planning to screw this up. Content models is a breakdown of the structure of content in a particular, a good content type. So, you know, in the news world or in the blog world, you have blog post is comprised of a title, a date, an author, an entry, and a bunch of other information attached to that. And the RSS content model is really simple. It's a title, a date, an author, and then a big text field. There's more complex content models for blog posts that are much richer than that. So, I mean, that's basically what content model is. And if you look at the actual XML document, you can sort of pick out what the major components are. Anyone else? Jesse?
I have a couple of thoughts about this. I think that the only thing that's really dead is the word page. And because I think that, I mean, based on my experience working with some of these things that you're talking about, so you quoted from the interview that I did with Boxes and Arrows on the occasion of the third anniversary of the release of the visual vocabulary, where I talked about kind of what I felt the limitations of that as a notation system were, namely that it couldn't kind of deal with these more dynamic kinds of situations. And then over the course of the last year, having had the opportunity to do some Ajax work, I was like, great, I can like kind of put it through its paces and try to break it and see where I need to extend the system in order to make it work more effectively. And what I actually found was that the system worked fine because I still had the need to represent discrete information elements distinct views of information in the user experience. Where my tools really started to break down was when I got to the wireframe point, which is what you were talking about with Dennis's example of because we've always assumed that we know exactly what a transition from one discrete information element to the next looks like, right? It's a click a link and then a blank window and then a new page loads. It's in representing those transitions where it really starts to break down. And I would say also to the point about RSS and remixing and all that kind of stuff that I don't quite get the attraction of the idea of this infinite undifferentiated information flow, because that's not the way that we efficiently process information. When I wrote my book, the first complaint that my publishers had about my approach was that I didn't have subheadings in my chapters. I was doing it as this kind of this narrative flow because that was the way that I was thinking about writing the information. But that's not the way that people process information. The way that we get meaning out of information is to break it down into discrete, identifiable segments. And that need on the part of our users isn't going to change. So we might stop using the word page to talk about those information segments, those information views, but those things are still going to exist, based on my experience.
Those segments will still exist. Okay.
I sort of agree with you that there's like certain paradigms that society is still very entrenched within. I think that there are going to be things that we're moving towards. I always sort of look towards sci-fi visions of the world and expectations and hope that lies if you realize there. One thing I wanted to point out is there's this thing I found on the web. It's called Epic 2014. Anyone else heard of this? Epic 2014. The URL is room.org/epic. And I can't do it as well as them. I can't present it. They have this whole multimedia presentation. But the whole thing is we're going towards Google's on, where Google and Amazon merge. The New York Times doesn't exist anymore. And that everything is about personalization. And it's as compelling a presentation as Bongo is. And I think that when I looked at that presentation, it was like this aha light bulb for me about where this remixing is and where the IT people aren't going to have a choice. Just like they're not going to be able to squash peer-to-peer to the end. It's the same thing that the technology has gotten to such a level where technology is better than IP.
Sure. There's time for one more if you want to wait. Talk about it.
Sort of with that IP, but also with this, the rich interface and the micro content on the different pieces of the page, when I take content and repurpose it or just use it for my own purposes, I'm losing that context of being able to go back and have state and having a URL that I can go back to and say, hey, this is where I got it from. And content and ideas are always updated and versioned. I may have something that was written in 1993 and it's in a PDF, but I can't go back and see easily what was done beyond that. So I have this document that was a picture in time from 1993, and they have morphed their ideas and taken in other ideas and remixed and repurposed other ideas, but being able to take a paragraph out and say, this is where this information came from. It's really hard right now on the web when you start repurposing information and moving that information to your desktop, let alone having sort of the Ajax model where you have different components on the page changing and saying, I was on this page, but what flavor of this page and in what state on that page was I when I got this information? That completely changed my world and how I viewed what I was doing, and I realized everything I had done up until that very minute was wrong, or wrong in the context I was trying to move it forward. And I'd like to be able to go back and point to that to share it with others, or to be able to say, at this point in time, this is what changed this. I need to go back and rewrite everything in this presentation, everything in this article that I'm doing, and be able to incorporate that. And I can't get back to that little teeny, that one sentence that flipped my world. And it's that sort of, you know, the stuff I've been playing with is getting to that and how we as designers and developers, we designed to get the information in front of somebody and our job's done rather than a checkbox. And it's like, as Gene's pointing out, we live beyond the page. It's, the information has other uses and another formats and another realms to how we deal with it, consume it, and repurpose it. And you know, we're not there yet with a context that allows to go back and actually anchor and give attribution if we wish, or to be able to get versions.
Transclusion.
Thank you.
Transclusion is a solution.
Get an RSS view for one sentence. So when that sentence is updated, the ideas around that sentence change. Our role can change a little bit also.
Okay. Well, if everyone wants to talk more, we could do that, or we could go to the next session. Okay, thanks a lot.